self-conscious.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. Sam Fromarts is going to be my guest. He is the editor-in-chief at FERN, which stands for Food and Environment Reporting Network. And I'll tell you more about Sam in a little bit when he comes on. But first, I want to talk to you about what's going on in the news, and of course share my recipe with you and some events you might want to participate in. I hope all of you who did celebrate the Jewish holiday yesterday had a easy fast and a nice break fast with family and friends. We had a big party here and it was a lot of fun. And in the Yom Kippur, being the Day of Atonement, is a day to ask people for forgiveness if you have wronged them or done anything over the past year that might have upset anybody. It's a good time to reflect on that and ask for forgiveness. So to all of you out there, Happy New Year. I wanted to share with you some things that I wrote about this week. This past weekend, I actually went to visit Swale, which is a floating food forest that has been docked at the Brooklyn Army Dock in Brooklyn. And it was really amazing to go on board this big barge and see actual fruit trees. There were peach trees, apple trees. The fruit was no longer there. They have handed it all out, but they still had kale. They still had grapes. Grapes, can you imagine, on a barge? It was amazing. And there's, you know, a lot of support from the city, and I think the Brooklyn Army Terminal is actually going to be purchasing the barge and keeping it going permanently. So that's big news and really exciting. And so they will be going sailing north to refurbish the barge and get it set for long-term survival. So anyway, if you haven't visited Swale, you'll have a chance again next spring when they come back. But Mary Mattingly, the artist behind this project, will be a guest on my show on October 25th, so I hope to have her there. I want to tell you all to save the date of November 3rd for the Long Island Food Conference. I'm one of the organizers of that food conference, and it is going to be at Long Island University at the former CW Post campus. And we're very excited to be welcoming Francis Moore Lappe as our keynote speaker, and we have great panelists lined up. The North Shore Land Alliance, who we've been working with, has been working on a huge other event. And so everything is not up online as we had hoped it would be by now, but it will be there by next week. So you'll be able to buy tickets then. So save the date for November 3rd, and tickets are coming soon. I also sent out in my newsletter, for those of you that have not participated in my Cooking for the Homeless for Thanksgiving and Christmas, it's hard to believe that I have to start thinking about Thanksgiving now, but I've been getting emails from past volunteers saying, when can I sign up? When can I sign up? So I just put together the Doodle Doc, and you can find it online now, where you can sign up to volunteer to cook for the big event, which will be taking place this year on November 20th. But the cooking takes place the weekend before, from November 17th through the 19th. And so the IE Green Homestead will host over 100 people through their doors, cooking for about 1,000 people. And if you have any connections and want to donate any food for that event, please send me an email at Bhavani@IEGreen. And what else? The Farm Bill. We will be talking more about the Farm Bill when my guest comes on. But the Farm Bill is going back to the discussion board, and the Farm Bill is such an important piece of legislation. It is the piece of legislation that decides on SNAP benefits for millions of people in this country who depend on that system for getting some food to their families. And the House bill or proposal really cut that drastically. And the Senate one, although not perfect, at least supported the SNAP benefits a little bit more. But we'll talk about that more later. But I have, you know, I have written about it in my newsletter, so check that out. There's also a petition on my website for getting glyphosate or Roundup, Monsanto's Roundup, out of school gardens. And that's really important. I know I've talked about the lawsuit that was just won by the groundskeeper, Dwayne Johnson, who has developed cancer from Roundup, and there was a huge winning for him, and it has encouraged many more lawsuits against Monsanto, and Monsanto, of course, is trying to fight it, and they were subpoenaing to try to turn that around, and that has been rejected. So anyway, there's a petition on my website to try to ban Roundup from school grounds because it's still being used, and there's, you know, enough documentation and proof that glyphosate does cause cancer, and we don't want it anywhere near our children. It also leaches into the water system, and we just don't want it, and we need our government to really protect us and not the big corporations. So please sign that petition. Also, local politics. We've been talking a lot about local politics with the current Trump administration, which we can't do that much about, although hopefully with this new information about Kavanaugh and the letter that the woman wrote about sexual harassment against him, hopefully that will delay the Kavanaugh hearings and maybe prevent him from being approved as a Supreme Court justice. But until that happens, we need to focus on local politics. And there is a fundraiser and local politics here on Long Island to try to unseat Peter King once and for all. And we're supporting Liuba Gretchen Shirley for Congress. And, you know, it's hopeful. And she's, you know, really doing a great grassroots organization to raise awareness about her campaign, and we need local politics. And this past week, there was a great summit in California that we'll talk about more when my guest comes on, about climate change. And this was a climate summit that took place in San Francisco, again, really trying to focus on local politics. In the past, the climate summits have all been heads of states and presidents, and we have not seen enough action being taken place. And so Jerry Brown, governor of California, organized this climate summit to really bring local politics, mayors and governors and people that really can make a difference more on a local level, to come together to see what they can do. And we'll talk more about that in a little bit. I do want to share with you some events going on in and around the New York area, and some actually in California too. So there's an Aquaponics Association conference taking place from September 21st to the 23rd, and that's in Hartford, Connecticut. You can buy a one-day pass or a full weekend pass. All of these events, by the way, are up on my website, where you can click on links to get to the right spot. This weekend, North Shore Land Alliance is having their wine auction and dinner, and that's always a fun event. It takes place at the Planting Fields Arboretum, and the North Shore Land Alliance is really protecting open space here on Long Island and doing a great job of it. So come out and support them. There's still tickets. On September 22nd, Long Island Progressives is organizing at the Sisters of St. Joseph in Brentwood a workshop to teach people how to become climate action supporters, and that will be taking place from 10 to 3. So if you're interested in local climate action, please come to that. September 24th to the 29th, Agritecture is partnering up with AgTechX for workshops all week long, and that's taking place in Brooklyn and other spaces in New York City. So you check that out. September 25th, Stone Barns is having their big gala celebration up in Tarrytown at the Stone Barn Center for Agriculture and Education. So that's a wonderful event. September 26th, CUNY is having an Urban Food Policy Forum. They do this every month. It's from 9 to 10:30. It's free. It's at the CUNY School of Public Health. And the theme this time is reducing corporate influences on diet-related non-communicable diseases. So check that out. September 29th, Orchestai Farm, which is a local farm here at the planting fields that works with young adults on the autistic spectrum. They're having a Moon Farm to Fork fundraiser on August 29th. That's from 4 to 7, and that's a wonderful organization. I'm actually doing a fundraiser helping to support them and another farm that also works with autistic kids called Elijah Farm. And we have brought Krishnadas, a kirtan singer, to the Cinema Arts Center. Unfortunately, I think it's already sold out, but that's October 3rd. So you might want to call and see if there's any extra tickets for that. September 29th. Through the 30th, California Vegetarian Food Festival is taking place. The ticket prices vary, so check that out. September 29th and 30th is the New York Vegandale Festival. That's on Randall's Island all day long. So that's the 29th and 30th. And then on October 1st, and we'll talk more about this when my guest comes on, FERN, which stands for the Food Environment Reporting Network, they're having one of their talks and eats events. And this time they are actually bringing on Ruth Rochelle from Gourmet Magazine and Chef Amanda Cohn from Dirt Candy, one of my favorite restaurants in the city, to have a conversation about the Me Too movement and how it relates to the restaurant business. So save your calendar and get a ticket for that. October 6th, oh, that was the Krishnadas concert that I just mentioned. And that's also a harvest fest on October 6th up at Stone Barn Center. That is a family event, much more affordable than the gala, all day long from 10 to 3. So check that out. October 8th, Food Tank is having their summit in New York City. Food Tank is actually the place where I first met today's guest, Sam, when he was on a panel at the first Food Tank Summit in D.C. So anyway, Food Tank is now going to many different cities, and the one in New York will be October 8th. There's still tickets. It's at the Tishman Auditorium at NYU, so check that out. And I have so many more events. I don't want to really take time. There's the Long Island Honeybee Conference coming up on the 14th and the 16th. And just go to my website. Oh, and November 3rd, as I mentioned earlier, is the Long Island Food Conference. Save that date. But go to my website and check out all the great events coming up. I want to share with you this week's recipe, which is kale chips. And I've just been harvesting so much kale out of my garden. I was like, what can I do with this? And this year for my birthday, my husband bought me a dehydrator, and I hadn't used it yet, so I just turned it on and used it for kale chips, and I also dried some cherry tomatoes. But here's a kale chip recipe that came out really nice. First, I made a puree of in my Vitamix with one small onion, one carrot, one celery, a half a cup of nutritional yeast, and 1 tablespoon of olive oil. And I mixed that up in the Vitamix first. And then I sprinkled that. I put that all over the kale chips. And then I laid them out flat onto the dehydrator trays. And if you don't have a dehydrator, not to worry. You can do it in a regular oven. Set it really low at like 125 degrees and just do it until crispy. Every oven's different, but it takes about 45 minutes in the dehydrator. 45 minutes in the oven and about 2 hours in the dehydrator. So, and also sprinkle with some salt, of course. I didn't mention the salt. Once you put it all out and lay it out, use some salt flakes. I love the Malden salt flakes. They're delicious. And just sprinkle it with that and put it in the dehydrator, and voila. You can bag them up, and they stay really fresh for a long time. So enjoy that, and now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Sam Frohmartz. He's the editor-in-chief at Fern. He's a veteran journalist who focuses on the intersection of the environment, food, and sustainable business. He began his career at Reuters News Agency in the mid-1980s, working as a correspondent in Washington and as deputy editor for Reuters Business Report in New York. And since leaving the news agency, his articles have appeared in Inc., Fortune, Business Week, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Atlantic Magazine's Life Channel, among other publications. He's the author of Organic Inc., Natural Foods and How They Grew, and also his more recent book is In Search of the Perfect Loaf, A Home Baker's Odyssey. So it's my pleasure to introduce Sam to all of you. Sam, are you with me?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining me. So before we dive in, can you just tell everyone a little bit about Fern and what you do there?
Yeah, so we're a nonprofit journalism organization. We're independent, we're investigative, and we cover issues having to do with food, agriculture, and environmental health. And so it's a pretty broad slate of topics that we cover. And everything, or nearly everything that we do, is produced in partnership with other media companies. So although all our stories appear on our website, which is at thefern.org, all of our stories also appear on, you know, much larger media company sites, or, you know, on broadcast networks, or, you know, newspapers or magazines, what have you. So our model is really to kind of amplify these issues by bringing them to much bigger partners.
Mm-hmm. And I know I've gone to your website often to talk about and write about many of the issues that you cover. And a lot of the issues I mentioned today, like the Farm Bill and the Climate Summit and, you know, all those issues that are just so important, I know that you've written about recently. Did you go out to San Francisco recently for the Climate Summit?
I did. I was out there for a few days and was at the summit. And it was pretty interesting. It was the first, you know, of these summits that I've been to, and actually participated in a side event where I led a couple of panels focusing on the impact of food, agriculture, and forestry on climate change. And those areas aren't really well recognized. Usually when we think of climate change, we think of oil and gas or electric cars or that kind of thing. But the way we produce food, the way we treat our forests has a huge impact. So that, you know, so I focused on that and actually wrote about that too, because there was a fair bit of activity in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I've heard statistics like food is responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions than all of the cars on the planet. Is that true?
I don't know if it's all of cars on the planet. You know, it depends how you measure it. But agriculture by itself is responsible for about a quarter of emissions. And if you include everything having to do with food, from production of fertilizer to packaging and transportation of food products, it's a third of all global emissions. And then, you know, and then the other, so it's a huge, you know, so the way we produce food has a huge impact. And the other area is, which are, you know, forests are cut down. And that kind of has a double impact, because forests soak up, you know, carbon from the air. Plants convert it, you know, into biomass, and they secrete it in the soil through their roots and, you know, everything else. So once you cut down a tree, you lose the ability of that source to soak up the carbon we're emitting. And so it becomes this huge, you know, it becomes this huge effect. So, and that accounts for like a sixth of all emissions. So, you know, between food and agriculture and forestry, you're really talking about a massive impact. And I think, yeah, I think, I mean, I've seen statistics like the four biggest food, the four biggest meat companies, meat production companies, for example, in the world, produce more emissions than any of the biggest oil and gas companies. So, you know,
really? Can you say that? Can you say that again so everybody really hears that and digests it? The four biggest meat companies. Go ahead.
The four biggest livestock producers in the world produce together more emissions than any of the largest oil companies. So, you know, these are not household names. You know, they're you know, in some cases, you know, companies, et cetera. But, you know, what's really not recognized is that livestock creates a huge amount of emissions, both through the feed that it takes to produce, that the animals eat, and also through their manure, as well as in the case of ruminants, which are like cows, they produce digestive gases at that, which are methane, which are much more powerful than CO2. So that has a big impact as well. So yeah, livestock has a huge impact, and it's just not really it's not really an area that's recognized. And actually, the side event that I was participating in, which was called 30 by 30, it was making the argument that changes in agriculture and forestry could get us 30% of the way towards the Paris climate goals by 2030. So, you know, that's nearly a third of the progress we need to make emissions can come from agriculture and forestry, just change practices. So you
mentioned how, you know, the narrative of meat production people seem to want to avoid, because I think, you know, if you really take that on, then you have to look at our meat consumption, and people don't want to look at that. People don't want to cut back on their meat. Was that discussed at all, of like changing the diet and how we can try to encourage more people to eat less meat so that we don't need to produce so much meat?
Yeah, and I mean that's definitely discussed. It's really difficult because, you know, as incomes rise, believe people tend to buy more meat, and so you've seen a dramatic rise in meat consumption in China, for example. But you know, even in the U.S., meat poultry consumption has gone up. So you know, I think unless incentives are crafted to make it less attractive, you know, it's not going to be an immediate choice by consumers to reduce their meat consumption. You know, people like meat, and if it's relatively cheap, you know, they'll buy it. So, you know, we always talk about in the environmental sector, like, you know, it's like this kind of wonky term, which is called externalities, which is produce something at a low cost, but somebody else is paying the price, either, you know, in terms of, environmental degradation or health. You know, we saw that, for example, recently in North Carolina, where there's a massive amount of hog farms, and neighbors who are mostly poor African-American people have sued because the air is so noxious from waste of these farms, you know. And we even saw it doubly so this week with, you know, Hurricane Florence, because a lot of these massive confined animal operations in low-lying areas, you know, were whacked by Hurricane Florence. These animal barns were flooded. You know, millions of animals have died, and the waste lagoons where the waste sits, you know, overflows into waters. you know, with massive implications for, you know, clean water and health. So, you know, that's...
Well, that's one part of the storm that I don't think people have even thought about. I know I haven't seen anything about that in the news, but, of course, I know that there's all those farms down there, so, of course, that makes sense, but I haven't seen anything about that. Wow.
Yeah, no, there was an article in the New York Times, which if you look on the food channel and their website, they had some pretty interesting pictures of these flooded animals, you know, barns.
Uh-huh.
We've done some reporting at the Fern and our Ag Insider and our Daily News Service on sort of the numbers of animal deaths and that kind of thing. It's really a horrendous situation, but it makes you ask the question, in an era of climate change and more extreme weather events, you know, should we really be placing these livestock operations in these areas? You know, regardless of the issue of you know, the costs of these operations, the environmental costs, you know, anywhere they're located. I mean, particularly in an area that's hit hurricanes, and you know, the same thing happened in Hurricane Matthew, you know, a while back, and now it's happened again, and it's much, you know, the loss of animal life and you know, and really farmers' livelihood. You know, has been much greater in this hurricane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think we also have to just look at the whole production industry and how we're creating cheap meat. I mean, we need meat to really be the true cost that it is. And you know, as you were saying, if they were responsible for the cleanup and not passing on those costs, and they actually had to pay for those costs, then the meat wouldn't be so cheap and people would eat less of it.
Yeah. Well, and I think one way to recognize those costs was in these lawsuits that these neighbors of these farms brought because of the, you know, noxious odors coming out of these manure lagoons. And they won multi-million-dollar verdicts. And so you could make an argument that external cost is now, you know, is recognized by courts, and it's being mm-hmm. Delivered in a judgment to the plaintiffs. But at the same time, North Carolina's legislature is really, you know, fighting to return to create laws so that these kind of what they're calling nuisance lawsuits, you know, can occur. So, you know, interesting about the use of language, they're called nuisance lawsuits when, you know, it's some, you know, when from the plaintiff's point of view, they've been harmed and want compensation.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, you know, you want government to be on the side of the people, not on the side of the corporations.
Well, I think also, I mean, the larger picture is, you know, I think this is just in terms of what potentially can happen, you know, with change. Were Paris Accord, which you know, the U.S. has stepped out of, called for limiting, you know, limiting the temperatures to 2 degrees Celsius, and that, you know, to prevent the worst effects of climate change. You know, if we don't do that, it's going to, you know, we're seeing with Hurricane Florence and, you know, other extreme weather events is going to be even more pronounced. You know, things like the massive forest fires we've seen out west, you know, the cases of, you know, 100, so-called 100-year storms, you know, happening every other year, you know, in which case they're not 100-year storms anymore. So, you know, unless we start to think, you know, more holistically, you know, about our actions, you know, these are the kind of things, that are going to become more prevalent, and the impacts on, you know, our food production system, among many other industries, is going to be, pronounced. And, yeah, you know, I've got to say, I think the encouraging thing at San Francisco was kind of work that's been going on at the state and local level, which was really, championed at that conference. And also, which was a little surprising, was the number of, companies that are stepping up and sort of recognizing and at least setting targets in terms of what they believe they have to do in order to help, turn this thing around. Every company was there. Obviously, you didn't have oil and gas industry, but you did have some major food companies. You had some major electronic companies. And, in certain areas like renewable energy, you're starting to see pretty dramatic shifts in the way renewable energy is being rolled out in certain parts of the world. So it's encouraging whether it can offset what's happening at the same time with continued expansion with coal. That's another question.
That's very hard when we have an administration that still is denying that climate change even exists. So
but the problem. The interesting thing, like, if you look at, renewable energy jobs in the U.S. are growing much faster than coal jobs. And that industry has been growing much faster. And if anything, coal has declined. So, it's in part regulation, but in part it's, there's cheaper alternatives. Change can happen, and first it comes really slow, but at a certain point it could potentially reach a tipping point, and then you get change in a much more dramatic fashion. That sometimes happens, and I think the fear was that it begins to happen on this climate issue. I'm not so sure it will, but that at least is the hope.
Mm-hmm. So did you leave the climate summit feeling a little optimistic, or like it's just more talk?
I didn't feel like it was just talk. I mean, I think there was a real recognition that things have to be done, and that were very real pledges being made. And I think it's the responsibility now to make sure that pledges are implemented. One interesting statistic which I wasn't aware of was that the cities and states that have signed onto climate accord or are following it represents in half the U.S. economy. So even on their own, states like California and others, and cities can take some pretty dramatic actions. Whether it'll be enough, is a question. But it's not as if progress is completely falling. So there is a resistance, as we might say.
Mm-hmm. Right. We're going to take a couple-minute break, Sam. When we come back, I'd like to actually talk with you about the Farm Bill, because I know you've covered that a lot. It's very confusing. People out there think, like, why do I have to even know about the Farm Bill? It doesn't affect me. And, I'd like to just make people aware of how it does and, some of the big issues that are being debated right now. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Sam Frommartz from FERN, and we will be right back.
I'm Gary Null, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
Everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Sam Frommartz from FERN, the Food and Environment Reporting Network, and we were just getting ready to talk about the Farm Bill. So, Sam, you with me?
I am.
So, FERN has covered just about every hiccup on the Farm Bill, and it's, you know, very complicated, and I don't know if the process this time around is any different than in the past, but can you share with us some of the issues being debated in the Farm Bill and why it's so important?
Yeah, well, I think maybe we should just back and discuss, explain what the Farm is in a really simple way. So it's a piece of legislation that is passed every 5 years, and it really has three main components. And one is it provides, authorizes money for food stamps, you know, the program known as SNAP benefits, as well as other related programs for women and children. The second part provides support for farmers in the case of low prices or crop failures, that kind of thing. And the third part of the Farm Bill has to do with conservation measures. In other words, paying farmers to land so that soils and sensitive areas can be preserved. So, you know, we actually have, if any of your listeners want to spend 6.5 minutes to understand the farm, we have a great animated video on our website at the.org. I think it's like the second or third item. And it's, you know, what is the farm and why does it matter? And it really explains, it dives these 3 points and also provides a little bit of the history about where the Farm Bill came from. And
wonderful.
I'll give you just a really sketch was the bill really came out of the Depression. And if you remember the Depression, people were hungry, right? They were short of food. And the second thing is in the West, we faced the Dust Bowl, right? The farming practices were so egregious, soil, that in a time of drought, the soil just picked up and blew away, you know, during skies as far away as New York. And so, so farmers went under, you know, soil disappeared and people were hungry. So those are kind of the three elements that the Farm Bill has been designed to deal with. What's happening now is there's a major controversy over SNAP benefits. SNAP benefits go over, you know, are paid to more than 40 million Americans, more than 8% of the population. Most of these people are the working poor. In other words, they have jobs, but they can't afford to buy food to feed their families because the wages they're paid are so low. And there is a measure in the Farm Bill to roll back SNAP benefits, and this was proposed by Republicans in the House version of the Farm Bill, and it was specifically targeted at what's called able-bodied working adults. These are people who can work, but either, you know, for whatever reason don't. Either for, you know, they might have health issues, they might have, you know, mental health issues, what have you. The measure says that if they, are not working or aren't in job training, that they'll potentially lose their benefits. And studies have indicated that, you know, this could affect 1 to 2 million people. So, Democrats and food advocates view it as a really onerous kind of measure, a proposal rather. And on the Senate side of the Farm Bill, the Democrats and Republicans on the Senate Agriculture Committee have a different version of the Farm Bill, which does not cut those benefits. So right now, the conference committee is going on where you're trying to merge the House version of the bill with the Senate version, and the Senate says if you have these SNAP benefit cuts in the Farm Bill, it just won't pass the Senate, and the House Republicans are saying that they won't, you know, they won't support any Farm Bill that doesn't cut back these benefits. So. You know, it's pretty stark, especially at a time when, you know, we're giving, massive tax cuts, to businesses and wealthy people, that, we're trying to pay for those tax cuts by rolling back, you know, benefits to the
benefits for the needy. Uh-huh.
And so the reason the Farm Bill has always passed is that you have Democrats and largely urban lawmakers who are very supportive of food security benefits, in other words, SNAP benefits and other benefits for poor people, voting in favor of the Farm Bill that helps, you know, farmers in the middle of the country. So. So you have these two coalitions, kind of the urban lawmakers and the farm state lawmakers, sort of coming together because each side kind of got what they want. But that coalition is now, you know, breaking down because, you know, Republican legislators from these farm states are demanding these cuts on the SNAP side. You know, the irony, of course, is that people may think of people getting food stamps as being in, you know, largely urban areas, but that's not the case anymore. It's actually in rural areas have the highest percentage of people getting SNAP benefits. So in really poor areas where there's, you know, less job opportunities, you know, people really depend on those benefits.
Right. So is there a deadline as to when this needs to be decided by?
Well, they wanted to get it done by the end of September, because the new year starts October 1. So that doesn't look like it's going to happen, in which case the previous Farm Bill will probably be extended until this one is worked out, if it can be worked out. So that's, you know, that's happened in the past. And we've seen many in Congress and many various pieces of legislation where basically the issue is punted because they can't come to any resolution. So it looks like that happened, although you never know, because, you know, things are going right now. So maybe they'll craft a compromise, or, you know, whether that could get enough votes behind it is a, you know, another issue. So it's just really hard to say. The other thing in the farm bill that people should recognize is there have been proposals to roll farm subsidies. That's, you know, payments to farmers when, you know, prices are low, for example, or when they have crop failures. But there were proposals to roll back these payments to the wealthiest farmers. And those in the latest farm bill, at least in the House version, were also not incorporated. So you have a bill that's basically boosting subsidy payments, or, you know, if you want to use the word corporate fair, to the richest farmers at the same time that you're trying to cut back food stamp benefit to the poorest people. So, you know, these are kind of issues that are under the radar. They're not well recognized, as you said, but it has, you know, it has huge implications for and farm policy and farm, you know, policy in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there anything that you recommend the average person do? Like, is there calling your senator or congressman or signing certain petitions or anything to help move this through?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always helpful to speak with your representatives, you know, and if you have a view on these issues, you know, make your voice heard. I don't know of positions, because that's not what we do. You know, we report what's going on. But I'm sure a quick search among hunger advocates and kind of thing, you know, conservation groups who are involved in these issues, would you could see quickly see, you know, avenues for participation.
Right. Now, I know you also covered that law case that I was talking about with Monsanto recently, where they lost the case against their glyphosate Roundup. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, this is a long-running controversy over the risks of glyphosate. And that's the active ingredient in Roundup, which is the world's most prevalent herbicide. So it's been approved in the U.S. It's been, you know, various scientific bodies have said it's safe. And but there was a couple of years ago, an agency of World Health Organization determined that it does have a cancer risk. And it was that determination which led to a whole host of lawsuits against Monsanto by cancer victim, claiming that Roundup was because of the cancer. And in this one case in California, it was a school groundskeeper who applied Roundup on school property. In a couple instances, the Roundup leaked, you know, on his skin. He subsequently got cancer, and what the jury determined was that the company, Monsanto, did not provide adequate warning labels on its product about potential cancer risks. So he won that case, and that was the first of you know, what are thousands of lawsuits that are faced by Monsanto, which is actually not a company anymore. It was bought by a much bigger company called Bayer. So it's actually the, you know, it's now the responsibility of Bayer to, you know, deal with these lawsuits, which it acquired, you know, in the acquisition of Monsanto. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there were a couple of interesting things about it. It was a pretty large verdict. It was almost $300 million. And the jury determined the verdict after 3 days of deliberation. So it wasn't a particularly long determination. Of course, Monsanto is fighting it. You know, they say that many scientific studies and reviews support them in arguing that glyphosate doesn't cause cancer. But, you know, like many scientific issues, you know, the science is still evolving. Studies are still ongoing. And so, you know, new determinations are being made. I will say, you know, this is not like a settled issue in the scientific community, at least. You know, you'll have scientists on both sides of the issue talking about the potential risks of this substance. So, so the science is not, you know, completely settled, but it was persuasive enough in this case and for this particular jury to say that there was a risk from the product, and the company did not have that risk on its label. So that's the issue, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in these. I think there's something like 5,000 some odd lawsuits, other lawsuits that the company's facing.
I actually heard 8,000, but whatever. It's a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a lot.
Right, so, right. Yeah. Amazing. You know, also, I always tell people, follow the money. I mean, because a lot of times the scientists that are saying glyphosate is safe, very often they have been paid off in some roundabout way, not an easy way to link it, but very often they have taken some money in some way from Monsanto in order to get that support. So at least that's what I've read. And
we had a pretty in-depth story on glyphosate last year that we did in partnership with The Nation. And you know, if you do a Google search, you could find it. And it sort of went into a lot of those issues about the way Monsanto was trying to influence the science to get more, not just the science, but the regulatory process to get more favorable rulings for its
right.
substance.
Right.
So
anyway, before we run out of time, Sam, I want to talk about this exciting event you have coming up on October 1st. And that Fern does regular events, right? So can you talk to us a little bit about the events that you do and this upcoming one on October 1st?
Yeah, so we're doing, this is going to be a really great event, and I hope anyone who's in New York City considers coming. It'll be a quiet night. You know, it's a Monday night. And the reason we do it on Monday is because we can get chefs to cook, like, amazing food for our events. Because it's their night off, and they agree to work on their night off. So this is it's in Brooklyn. It's at the Green Building. We have a lot more information at our website. You can either go to thefern.org or directly to ferntalkseats.com. So that's plural, ferntalkseats.com. And we're having a panel of four people, and it was really prompted by the scandals that were rocking the restaurant industry, you know, with these prominent chefs being called out in the Me Too movement for harassment, abuse, and other issues. Amanda Cohen, who's a chef at the vegetarian restaurant Dirt Candy, I love that restaurant. She wrote an essay in Esquire saying that women chefs have been ignored so long, but once they become victims of harassment, suddenly they're interesting to the media. So she was kind of calling out, you know, the whole flurry, she wasn't criticizing this reporting. She was just saying, why does it take, you know, these kind of scandals for women chefs to be recognized and written about? Ruth Reichel, who's, you know, a long time, really prominent critic at the New York Times and then currently Gourmet, editor of Gourmet magazine, when the magazine was still around. She's going to speak on these issues as well. And, you know, we widen the issues. It's not just the Me Too issues, but it's really broader issues of equity and access in the restaurant industry, you know, of color, to people of color. We have Ashton Berry, bartender, activist, outspoken activist about these issues, as well as who runs a puts for being and queer. So it's really a diverse of perspective and eating experience in us. Great. This is the building, a chef, the union, hospital, which is a group of Union Square thing.
We're losing our connection. It's going in and out a little bit, but I will. It's very exciting. I'll be there, and I will post all the information about your event on my website. It already is up there. I even have a link so that people can go right to your website to get the tickets from my website. So, anyway, Sam, so much for joining us. It's been wonderful, and I look forward to seeing you on October 1st.
Okay.
Thank you. And everyone out there who's been listening, thank you for joining us, and I will see you all again next week. Bye for now. I'm a